This week, U.S. fighter jets launched airstrikes on targets in eastern Syria, linked to Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps.
My warning to the Ayatollah was that if they continue to move against those troops, we will respond, and he should be prepared. It has nothing to do with Israel.
We'll hear about the impact of the Israel-Hamas conflict on international security issues.
The conflict might spread further. Hezbollah, for example, might also join in on attacking Israel. So the immediate effect is definitely continue to be a lot more violence in the Middle East.
And an official from the World Health Organization tells us about the deterioration of the healthcare system in Gaza. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The Pentagon says U.S. fighter jets launched airstrikes early Friday on two locations in eastern Syria linked to Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. At a news conference Wednesday, President Joe Biden said he warned Iran's supreme leader that Tehran would face retaliation for strikes on American personnel by Iranian-backed militia groups.
My warning to the Ayatollah was that if they continue to move against those troops, we will respond. And he should be prepared. It has nothing to do with Israel.
The U.S. does not have any information yet on casualties or on an assessment of damage from Friday's strikes. For more on the U.S. airstrikes in Syria, International Edition's Steve Karish spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
The U.S. military has conducted what they refer to as self-defense strikes on two facilities in eastern Syria that they say are used by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and Iranian-backed proxy groups. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin says the precision strikes are a response to this series of strikes that have been going on against U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria over the past few days. Our latest tally that I have from multiple officials is that at least 17 attacks have occurred in Iraq and Syria over the last few days. Because of this, because of all of these injuries and this death, the secretary said that there is safety of U.S. personnel is a priority. And he said that the president directed these strikes that happened tonight because he said that he wanted to make clear that the United States will not tolerate such attacks and will defend itself, its personnel, and its interests.
And is the Pentagon saying that the previous strikes on American forces in the region originated from these facilities in Syria?
They have not gotten into that level of specificity at this point, but we do know that the Pentagon has reiterated several times, and the White House has reiterated several times, that these attacks over the last few days were conducted by Iranian-backed proxies that are funded by Iran, and ultimately they hold Iran accountable for these actions. But they said this is not, in their minds, this is not intended to expand the war. It was narrowly tailored to defend U.S. personnel in Iraq and Syria, the Pentagon says, and it has nothing to do with the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hamas, with the defense secretary saying tonight that they do not want this to constitute a shift in the U.S. approach to the Israel-Hamas conflict. They urge all state and non-state actors in the region not to escalate this into a broader regional war.
Do we know what the United States used to make these attacks? Was it troops? Was it planes? How did it happen?
This was an aerial assault. I am unclear if it was manned or unmanned aircraft at this time, but it was definitely airstrikes that were conducted. And I have been told by officials that these strikes had been planned for several days, that they were waiting for the right timing, the right conditions to strike back against these proxy groups.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Carla, thanks for your reporting on this breaking story.
You're welcome.
The UN General Assembly has scheduled a vote for Friday on a resolution calling for a humanitarian truce in Gaza, leading to a ceasefire of hostilities between Israel and Gaza's Hamas rulers. The results were not available by our recording deadline. VOA will have the result and updated coverage on our website, voanews.com. The Israeli military on Friday said its ground forces were expanding their activity in the Gaza Strip as the army moved closer to a full-on ground invasion of the besieged territory. I spoke with Dr. Stuart Kaufman with the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware about the impact of the Israel-Hamas conflict on international security issues.
Well, obviously, in the short run, it means a lot more violence, a lot more death and devastation. Israel is determined to react very strongly to what is for them a 9/11 moment. So there's going to be a lot more violence, especially around in the Gaza Strip. And of course, the U.S. is also worried, and Israel is worried, that the conflict might spread further. Hezbollah, for example, might also join in on attacking Israel. So the immediate effect is definitely continue to be a lot more violence in the Middle East.
President Biden's administration has pledged unwavering support with Israel, while Iran, Qatar, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and other Arab nations and groups are siding with Hamas. Are these alliances on each side making or has made adding to the international tension? If so, how?
So the tension is over the question, as I alluded to already, about whether other countries or groups will get involved actively by engaging in violence. So, as I mentioned, Israel and the U.S. are concerned that Hezbollah will escalate its attacks on Israel, either with a larger barrage of rockets or even on the ground. And the expectation, the understanding is that to the extent that Hezbollah does this sort of thing, it'll be at the direction of Iran. So the tensions are over whether that kind of escalation is going to happen. And that's the reason why the United States has sent now two aircraft carrier battle groups to the region. One is already in the Eastern Mediterranean. The other is on its way to the Indian Ocean to stand off, assuming presumably in the vicinity of Iran in the Arabian Sea, to send a message to Iran, as President Biden said, don't.
What is the significance of sending out these carrier strike groups, and what role do you think they will be playing regarding this Middle East conflict?
So the idea is to send a message of deterrence. The Eisenhower, as I mentioned, is now expected to continue going not just to the Eastern Mediterranean, but all the way into the Arabian Sea near the Persian Gulf. So the point is to have one aircraft carrier battle group off the coast of Lebanon to create the U.S. capability to immediately strike Hezbollah targets in case Hezbollah intervenes more openly in the war, and to park another one in the general vicinity of Iran to send the same message of deterrence to Iran, that if they get directly involved, they would also be potentially subject to airstrikes from the aircraft carrier battle group.
Have you heard of any other nation or group that is supporting Hamas sending similar naval support?
I have not heard anything about that.
And finally, is there a possibility that through all of these multi-country alliances, that the significant global crisis could wind up blending together? And that could be a way of potentially starting World War III. If so, how do you see such a scenario playing out?
I think that is exceptionally unlikely. You know, a world war pretty much by definition means a war between great powers. Russia is bogged down in its war with Ukraine right now. China is involved with its own concerns. So I see zero possibility of a war between great powers starting as a result of what's going on now. You know, worst case scenario, it seems to me, is Iran specializes in unconventional war, in supporting proxy groups and terrorist groups. So while it's certainly imaginable that there could be an exchange of missile strikes and airstrikes involving Iran, I would be very, very surprised if things escalated any further than that. And I tend to be pessimistic. So that's my assessment.
That was Dr. Stuart Kaufman with the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. The healthcare system in Gaza continues to deteriorate since the beginning of the Israel-Hamas conflict. I spoke with Dr. Ahmad Al-Mantari, the World Health Organization's regional director for the Eastern Mediterranean region, who gives us this update on the healthcare crisis in Gaza.
The situation there is really very bad, you know, based on the data that we are receiving on a regular basis, you know, from the country office. Generally speaking, you know, there are 35 hospitals there in Gaza. Unfortunately, 34% of them are not working, which is about 12 hospitals. either due to direct attacks, you know, damage due to direct attacks, or due to shortage of fuel. There are around 72 primary healthcare centers. 64% of them are not working, which is around 46 health centers due to the same reasons. In addition to these, you know, closed hospitals, there is a very severe shortage of water into these healthcare facilities, as well as to the public. There is a severe shortage of fuel, which, as I said, led into closure of some hospitals and healthcare facilities. In addition to that, there is a huge, severe shortage of medical supplies, particularly medications, as we call them, life-saving medications, like the one used for operations and deliveries. And as you know, trauma is high there in that area, and people need to go to operation theater. And this is one of the challenges we are facing. There are around 350,000 people who are suffering from non-communicable diseases like diabetes, hypertension, cancer, and bronchial asthma, which is, threatening them by not having their medications, like insulin, for example. There are around 50,000 pregnant women, which are, also threatened by not having delivery in skilled healthcare workers, and there are around 9,000 people who are suffering from cancer, for example, of different types. They need medications, and they might, lack it. There are around 1,000 people who are suffering from renal failure. They need renal dialysis on a regular basis. They are lacking it because of shortage of water, because of shortage of fuel, which is ultimately leading to closure of some of the healthcare facilities. So this is briefly the situation there in Gaza.
There are no supplies coming in at all to replace the medical supplies that have been used up so far.
I mean, there was, as you heard, shipment of supplies on 21st October from Rafah cross border, 20 trucks. Four of these trucks were delivered by WHO of medical supplies. But unfortunately, it is like, a drop in an ocean. Mm-hmm. Definitely, these supplies are not sufficient. And we have to have, maybe 100 of trucks on a daily basis to provide these supplies of medical, supplies, water, food, fuel, and other basic essential life supplies. So these are never, enough based on the high demand of these supplies in that place.
That was Dr. Ahmad Al-Mandhari, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for the Eastern Mediterranean region. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Rick Pantaleo. As tensions in the Middle East escalate following the Hamas terror attack on Israel and Israel's subsequent bombing of Hamas targets in Gaza, the future of Iran's nuclear program remains unresolved. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the West sees Tehran as the major backer of Hamas, and the group's attack on Israel has set back efforts to de-escalate tensions with Iran.
Western leaders see Iran as the major supporter of Hamas militants, but have not accused Tehran of direct involvement in the group's October 7th cross-border attack on Israel. Prior to the attack, relations between the West and Iran had been cautiously improving. In September, the United States struck a prisoner swap deal with Tehran and released $6 billion of frozen Iranian assets. That money has since been refrozen.
There was room for direct negotiations towards the end of October between Iran and the U.S. In Oman. But that, I think, is now completely off the books. And there is probably no political space left for direct engagement between the two countries.
Talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, stalled last year, though neither side has said it is officially finished. The United States pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, and Iran stopped complying with its commitments soon after. The UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, said in its August report that Iran was continuing to enrich uranium up to 60% purity, short of 90% weapons-grade fuel. Iran has removed IAEA monitoring equipment and has blocked some inspectors from visiting the country.
As part of the escalatory understanding between Iran and the US, Iran stopped accumulating additional 60% enriched uranium. Well, that might now change given the rising tensions between the two sides. It would take Iran less than a week to enrich enough uranium for a single nuclear weapon. And that's why this is literally a ticking bomb. There needs to be a solution one way or another to curb Iran's nuclear activities.
IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi said he saw no correlation between the Israel-Hamas war and Iran's nuclear program.
There's still no evidence that Iran is contemplating a move away from compliance with its essential nuclear non-proliferation treaty commitment, which is to refrain from manufacturing nuclear weapons.
Could Tehran seek to use its nuclear program as leverage against the West as tensions increase in the region?
I can imagine them looking for ways of increasing concern and anxiety in the West about their nuclear program, but stopping short of actually, shall we say, crossing the line and ceasing to be in compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Meanwhile, Israel has repeatedly said it would not allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. Israel itself is widely believed to have atomic weapons, though it does not allow IAEA inspections of its nuclear sites. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Republican Representative Mike Johnson was elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Wednesday, ending lawmakers' 22-day struggle to pick up one of the top leadership posts in the U.S. government. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
By a vote of 220 to 209, Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives finally ended 3 weeks of fighting and indecision to pick a leader.
Honorable Mike Johnson of the state of Louisiana, having received a majority of the votes cast, is duly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives.
The new Speaker of the House is conservative Republican Representative Mike Johnson. Republican Representative Elise Stefanik of New York.
A man of deep faith, Mike epitomizes what it means to be a servant leader. A deeply respected constitutional lawyer, Mike has dedicated his life to preserving America's great principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
The lower chamber of the U.S. Congress has been without a leader and unable to pass legislation since October 3rd, when Republican Kevin McCarthy became the first ever Speaker of the House to be removed from power. Eight conservative members of his own party, along with all Democrats, voted him out for passing a short-term funding bill for the government. Casey Burgat is the Legislative Affairs Program Director at the George Washington University Graduate School of Political Management.
There's been a lot of internal turmoil within the Republican Conference for really the last decade or so, and it's been slowly piecing and becoming more exposed in more public ways. And this really hit the head when the funding battle was necessary to fund the government. Speaker McCarthy couldn't find enough votes within his own conference.
Three-term Congressman Johnson was nominated late Tuesday after Representative Tom Emmer withdrew his candidacy following former President Donald Trump's social media post criticizing him for being a Republican in name only. Trump praised Johnson early Wednesday.
I think Mike Johnson is doing very well. He's a tremendous congressman, respected by everybody. I hear it looks like it's really good. I haven't had one negative comment about him. Everybody likes him. Just respected by all.
Johnson, who is now second in the presidential line of succession after Vice President Kamala Harris, is strongly anti-abortion and was one of the leaders of the effort among Republican lawmakers to overturn the results of the 2020 election. All 209 House Democrats voted for their leader, Hakeem Jeffries, and warned Johnson's views are too extreme. Democratic Representative Pete Aguilar of California.
Has this been about something else? Has this been about a focus of House Republicans to find the person who can pass their extreme litmus test to oppose marriage equality, enact a nationwide abortion ban, without exceptions, gut Social Security and Medicare, and support overturning a free and fair election.
U.S. lawmakers have just 23 days until the short-term government funding bill runs out. They are also expected to debate the White House request for $61 billion in aid to Ukraine and $14 billion in aid for Israel. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
A new study from the British Antarctic Survey suggests the West Antarctic ice sheet will continue to increase its rate of melting over the rest of the century, no matter how much we reduce fossil fuel use. I spoke with Caitlin Naughton, who is the lead author of the study and a researcher at the British Antarctic Survey, about the study's findings.
Yes, the West Antarctic ice sheet is basically a system of interconnected glaciers. Glaciers form when snow falls, but it doesn't get warm enough in the summer to melt it. So it builds up and up over the year and a glacier forms. And if you have enough glaciers all interconnected, you call it an ice sheet, like a Greenland or Antarctica. The West Antarctic ice sheet is a bit special because much of it is actually resting on rock, which is below sea level. And this means that the ocean has the potential to access it. So anywhere the rock is below sea level, the ocean could melt its way in if the water was warm enough. And that's what we're starting to see in West Antarctica, especially in the region called the Amundsen Sea. We're seeing ice shelves, which are the floating parts of the ice sheet around the edges, starting to thin. And this causes the glaciers behind them to speed up their flow into the ocean. And this causes sea level rise.
The ice sheet has been melting for a while now, but your findings indicate that a substantial acceleration in ice melting likely cannot be now avoided. What is driving the melting, and why would the rate of melting increase accelerate?
So the melting is being driven by the ocean. And the ocean is in direct contact with the ice shelves around the edges of the ice sheet, which are actually floating. So the main process which causes the ocean to warm right up against the ice shelves, we think is that the transport of warmer water from the deep ocean up towards the coast, towards the ice shelves. And these ocean currents, which transport the warm water towards the ice shelves, our modeling suggests that climate change causes these currents to strengthen and to increase the amount of warm water that reaches the ice shelves, and therefore to increase the rate of melting.
What kind of timeline are we talking about regarding the melting of the West Antarctic's ice sheet and its predicted collapse?
It's very difficult to know how quickly the ice sheet will respond to these changes in ocean temperature and changes to melting around the edges. This is because we've never directly observed the collapse of an ice sheet in real time. All we have to go on are records and fossils, for example, of how we think the ice sheet changed in prehistoric times, such as the ice ages and the interglacials and ancient climate changes, which got completely deglaciated Antarctica, and also models. So we think that the ice sheets respond on the order of centuries. The very full response can take thousands of years, but you'll get the bulk of the response to changes in climate, changes in ocean temperature, in a few centuries. So 2100 was the end of the study period of my models. 2100, as far as the ice sheet is concerned, is just the beginning. So its full response to the ocean changes that we're simulating, we think, would take hundreds of years.
Now, your study suggests that this increase in melting may be unavoidable no matter how much we reduce fossil fuel use. So I'm taking what we're talking about are carbon reductions that are much more than what has been suggested internationally.
Exactly. So the most ambitious scenario that we simulated was a scenario in which global warming is limited to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So we're already at about 1.2 degrees. In order to stop at 1.5 degrees, it would be extremely challenging. We would have to not only reach net zero worldwide, which we're not close to doing, but we'd also have to start taking carbon out of the atmosphere to stabilize the climate.
That was Caitlin Naughton, a researcher at the British Antarctic Survey. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Rick Pantaleo.